Hi, welcome to China Unscripted. I'm your speaker, Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
And I'm Matt Gnaizda.
Speaker was a little weird, wasn't it?
I was just confused.
I was too. I don't know what's going to come out.
You're still a host, even if it's not video, dude.
Well, I felt like it would be a little selfish of me to be like, oh, I'm the host, and here are the other two people.
I mean...
Well, that's why I said speaker, but speaker didn't really work.
Why don't you say I'm Chris Chappell?
What an idea.
Okay.
Don't label yourself, Chris. Come on.
Oh my gosh, this is so uplifting. I hope everyone listening is also uplifted. Don't label yourself.
Yes. Coming out soon, Chris's self-help book.
Oh, lie to yourself.
Lie
That's
to yourself.
That's right. Yeah. Wasn't that when we were in Australia, I came up with the idea to have a self-help book called Lie to Yourself. 10 big lies to tell yourself to get out of bed in the morning.
Yes. Yes. I mean, I think there would be a big market for that.
I do. Well, if you'd like me to make that book, let us know. Hey, it's 10 years since China has hosted the Olympics.
Speaking of big lies.
Big lie. Oh, that was good, Matt. Back then it was lovingly referred to as China's coming out party.
In the traditional sense?
What other sense is there?
Okay, moving on.
And clearly, after exposing itself to the world, China, the Chinese Communist Party, has completely reformed and become a multi-party democracy, right?
Yes, in an alternate universe.
Oh, we're not in that universe?
I think we're definitely in the weirdest universe.
Oh, man, how did that happen?
Well, I think that in 2001, there was a lot of hope, for some reason, that the Olympics would force China to make political reform.
Mm-hmm. Instead, they kicked a bunch of people out of their homes and bulldozed their homes and built Olympic stadiums and cracked down on everything.
Well, I mean, it wasn't in some ways a totally like out there idea. Like people were kind of comparing it to what happened in 1988 with the Seoul Olympics, where like South Korea was more authoritarian government.
It was authoritarian, but they were already at a point where they were ready to make some reforms.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't necessarily happen in every country. Like it's not like the Russian Olympics forced Russia to, you know, have legitimate elections. It's not like the 1936 Olympics, you know, made Germany become less authoritarian.
What was going on in Germany in 1936?
Oh, nothing much. Probably nothing of any historical note.
Oh, okay. Well, I certainly won't learn from it.
So, anyway, the idea that, like, the Olympics could be good for China wasn't, like...
Well, yeah.
Well, it was good for China. It just depends on what you mean by China.
That's true, and I guess it depends what you mean by good.
Well, this has been sort of the argument, basically starting in the 90s and moving on, that by engaging with the Chinese Communist Party, that will force the country to have reforms.
I think, actually, we can place this firmly in the lap of Nixon and Kissinger.
Something about Nixon, lap, and Kissinger is too close. That's
No, okay. But, like, seriously, ever since the U.S. decided to use China basically to counter the Soviet Union in the 70s, but like, you know, that started the whole like legitimizing the Chinese Communist government.
Well, I think that it's sort of a lie we were told in the 70s that engaging with China would force China to make political reforms. Like, it was clearly Nixon and Kissinger's strategy to use the relationship with the Chinese Communist Party to counterbalance the Soviet Union. But I think the lie they told the public was that, oh, well, this is, you know, mainly because it's going to help China reform. And like, it's not to say that the U.S. didn't have a geostrategic reason to do it. It's just that, like, I don't think that the reform part was very important to Nixon or Kissinger. Like, that's the part that didn't work.
Hey, I don't want to hear any criticisms of Nixon on this show.
I mean, did Nixon ever do anything wrong?
Nothing I can think of. Shelley stares blankly at the wall.
Oh, God. Okay. Well, it is true, though, that, like, I don't know if it was so much the whole, like, this will force China to reform. There's two parts of it. There's part of it that's like, well, if we, it's not so much about forcing, but about like, well, if we engage, that's better than not engaging, right? And then engagement will lead to reform.
But I'll tell you why that's a lie. Because why didn't we make that argument with Cuba? Because Cuba was an evil communist regime, right? According to that exact, those exact same people in the 1970s. Oh, you can't engage with Cuba. We've got to have an embargo. They're run by a totalitarian communist dictatorship, right? And yet, somehow the rules change when it comes to China.
Yeah, you don't understand, Matt. China has 750 million people.
At the time, parentheses, asterisks, see footnote.
Yeah, so I mean, that's exactly my point, right? And I think Bill Clinton made essentially the same public argument, which is that if we engage economically with China by bringing them into the WTO, that's going to force them to reform. When, again, like that was the part that, that was the pitch to the public, when the reality is that Bill Clinton was feeling a lot of pressure from American corporations to open up the China market so we could start selling American goods to China. So again, like you have this lie, which is, oh, engagement will force China to open up. It will force the Communist Party to make political reforms. But the reality is the motivation for politicians doing that is something else entirely.
I mean, lie is a strong word. Are you sure it was a lie and not just like
a non-truth?
A misplaced hope? Like an optimistic, you know, yeah, an optimistic thought.
Like, I'm optimistic that...
Here comes one of Matt's analogies.
Oh, okay.
Like, I'm optimistic that if I put on a costume and go to this party, that everyone else will be wearing a costume.
That's all right. Okay. They're great. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Awesome. Okay. We'll go with that. But so it's interesting that you mentioned Kissinger, because there's this idea of elite capture that the Chinese Communist Party is trying to basically get influential Westerners on its side to have this positive view of China. And Kissinger is one of those people who for decades has been kind of saying what you call a lie and what you, shall we call,
misplaced optimism.
And the Olympics really was a chance for China to sell this idea around the world, to project itself as something other than a brutal authoritarian communist dictatorship.
Yeah, it was actually really successful in that, I think. Just even the opening ceremony. Do you guys remember the opening ceremony?
Who could forget?
Even now, like 10 years later, I've had conversations with people where they just talk about, like, just Americans who don't really know a lot or aren't very engaged with China. They talk about how impressive the Beijing Olympics were and how impressive that opening ceremony was with, like, all those thousands of people, like, doing all these things. And like,
In unison. Amazing what a totalitarian regime can get a bunch of people to do together at the same time.
Yeah. Totally not creepy. But, like, yeah, like, the whole, like, idea of, like, and, like, using Chinese culture to give legitimacy to this authoritarian communist government.
Yeah, like none of the dancers were, you know, Red Guards.
They skipped
the entire 20th century and went back to, like, you know, Confucian scholars dancing.
I mean, like, seriously, that is part of Chinese history. And you could, like, argue that, yes, like, if you're celebrating Chinese history, this is, of course you should talk about Confucius and stuff. But the way that they use it is definitely to make people, as like a distraction, to be like, look at how glorious the Chinese culture is. Don't worry about what's happening right now. Everything's fine.
Ignore the people getting their organs harvested behind the curtain.
Yeah, although that was not...
That was happening. It was not publicly known.
Yeah, it was not very publicly known.
It was kind of considered like a fringe conspiracy theory at the time.
Well, maybe not even that yet. Yeah. Like,
there were talks of, I forget his name, but that doctor who had performed some kind of surgery on like somebody who was just executed and he thought it was live. I think it was in Xinjiang.
I don't think that had come out yet.
Had that not come out yet?
I don't think in 2008.
I don't think the organ harvesting thing really started to get mainstream acceptance until like 2 years ago.
I was going to say mainstream acceptance.
It's
is
even
probably,
not yet mainstream acceptance.
Well, even in 2008, we knew that there were some bad things happening in China.
Oh, definitely. That's definitely true.
It was just unclear how bad or how big of a scale it was.
Yeah, and you notice the one thing that they didn't bring up about Confucius is when he said that if the rulers violate the will of heaven, it's the duty of the people to criticize and stand up.
What? Confucius didn't say that. Confucius said, obey the government, always. Yes.
Yes, that's Confucianism. It's that one idea. Just listen to people in charge.
Yes, filial piety. Listen to your betters. Yeah, la 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 la.
Yeah, don't bother to actually read the Analects or anything by Xunzi or Mencius.
Oh, that actually is a good question. I wonder if they teach the Analects in Confucius Institutes. What do you think?
Oh, that's a good question. Excuse me, are we ever going to learn about Confucius? Can we read anything he wrote?
Well, I wonder if anyone, you know, if you're listening to this and you are studying at a Confucius Institute, it'd be interesting if you let us know in the comments, like, what kind of material they use to teach.
Yeah, how much of it relates to Confucius? Probably not a lot. It's
probably
more of like a good PR move than anything else. But yeah.
Speaking of the Olympics and how they used PR, Shelley, remember that adorable little girl who sang that song?
Yes, I do, in the opening ceremony. And then it turned out that she wasn't singing at all.
She was lip syncing to a song sung by a less attractive girl with a better voice.
It wasn't that the other girl was ugly. Like, she was also a cute little girl, but, like, she had lost some of her baby teeth. So you know how, like, kids, like, have that, like, awkward, like, mouth phase where you've got, like, some adult teeth in and some baby teeth? And I guess that wasn't adorable enough.
She would have made the nations of the world vomit in disgust.
Yeah, so it's one of those weird scandals that happen, like the footprints.
It's just because it's a cover-up for no reason.
Well, I think it kind of speaks to how much control they, like, the Communist Party felt like they needed to have over everything in the Olympics to make everything seem perfect. Like, you know, trying to seed the clouds to, like, make sure it didn't rain during the Olympics.
Shut down all the factories.
Yeah, shutting down all the factories. I mean, air pollution was a huge problem, still is a big problem, but
possibly
they were like,
worse now.
But they were like, oh yeah, like, we're just gonna make sure that the air quality is good by shutting down factories or making sure that people can't drive their cars except on alternate days. But this one thing about the little girl singing was so petty in a way, but also just really represented how, like, to what degree that they would go, where they're like, I mean, why couldn't you find a girl who had a good voice and was adorable? I'm sure that those people are out there, but they wanted the perfect looking girl and the perfect sounding girl, and nobody will ever find out that they're not the same girl. Or like the footprint fireworks that were supposedly, like, going across the Beijing skyline, which were just digitally done.
What? I didn't.
You didn't know about this?
I didn't know about this.
Like,
what
there
happened?
The way the opening ceremony begins with these, like, fireworks that look like footprints, like, traveling, like, by the Forbidden City and stuff like that. And, like, you could see it on television. But, you know, if you went outside in Beijing that night, you would not see any fireworks because those were digital fireworks.
Whoa.
They weren't real fireworks, but, like, it came out later that they were digital, which, like, again, it's not a huge scandal, but, you know, it just, I think these little things added up to this idea that
it's just like another small lie for no reason.
Yeah.
Well, it shows how the party looked at the Olympics. It was there. It was super important for the Communist Party to trick the world into viewing China a certain way. And that was the foundation for a lot of things that has happened since. The party was using the Olympics as a way to paint a more China-friendly image of itself to the world, and from that, as a platform, it was able to manipulate the world and get away with a lot of things it wouldn't otherwise have been, because it helped erase the idea of China, the communist totalitarian dictatorship that runs over students with tanks, to China, it has pandas.
Right, and 5,000 years of culture.
Well, and they did another thing that was sort of unique in the history of Olympics, which is the multi-country, international Olympic torch relay.
Didn't they go, like, around the world?
Yeah, they went to, everywhere, like, through parts of Asia, Australia, U.S., Europe. U.S. They started in Greece, but they kind of, like, made this huge loop around. And kind of, like, running the torch through all these different cities. Like, it's not just, like, running it, like, from the, Beijing Forbidden City to the Olympic Stadium. It's like, we're going to make this a whole global affair.
I mean, I think normally it is run from Athens. Like, the torch is lit on Mount Olympus and then, like, travels from Athens to the host country. But what China did was different in that, first, it had to go all around the world.
Right.
Before it went to the host country. And very publicly, too.
Right. And as we recall, when it went through different cities around the world, everyone celebrated it, and there were absolutely no protesters at all.
And there were, busloads of Chinese people who spontaneously decided to get together and, celebrate the torch relay.
By accepting money and little red flags to get on a bus and go across, the state or whatever to join the support team.
And conveniently block any protesters that happened to be standing around.
What protesters? What Tibetans? What Falun Gong protesters?
There were a couple of cases of people trying to swipe the torch, right? Trying to extinguish it.
I don't remember. Well, so with the protesters, one interesting thing that happened was that the article that came out a few weeks ago in Politico magazine about how Chinese spies are infiltrating Silicon Valley. One of the anecdotes they talked about was when the torch relay for the Beijing Olympics came to San Francisco, that, of course, there were protesters and there were people who were bussed in to, be patriotic supporters. And the fact that apparently the Chinese Ministry of State Security actually sent agents into the U.S., to monitor that torch relay and to, monitor the protesters and, coordinate all that with the consulate, which I remember at the time reporting about the protests, reporting about the people coming, but it wasn't public that the Chinese, like, intelligence operatives had come to take charge of this.
And that that Politico article you mentioned has a lot of significance for us this week. And we'll get back to that in just a moment. But I think also for context, it's important to remember what was going on in China in 2008. That was also the year of the Sichuan earthquake, where a bunch of school children were crushed because local officials had embezzled money meant for construction. That was also the year when there was a massive Tibetan uprising. Uprising is probably not the best word to describe it. But there was a lot of unrest in Tibet. It was also the tainted milk scandal where
the company Sanlu was putting melamine in milk to sort of trick the testing apparatus to make it look like it had more protein.
And it sickened a lot of infants and killed a few.
That didn't come out till after the Olympics, though, because the government basically hushed it down until after the Olympics happened.
Yes, it's more important that the Olympics go well than people to know that the milk they're drinking or giving their babies might be toxic.
Yeah, priorities, people.
Priorities. Misplaced optimism.
I mean, it was definitely a very momentous year, I guess you could say, in terms of what was happening in China. And one of the things that they had promised with the Olympics was to allow, for more free speech, to allow for freer internet, which they didn't really fulfill. They kind of reduced some of the censorship, but it was hardly uncensored.
Well, they had like a place where the foreigners and reporters could get, full access to the internet.
Yes. They were like, yes, you will be able to interview, dissidents, like you'll be able to have free rein to go interview people you like. And we know from talking to Fang Jian how that ended up, where he was telling the story of how
just so everyone remembers, Fang Jian was the Tiananmen Square massacre survivor we interviewed a couple of months ago, who had his legs crushed
by a tank.
Well, what's interesting is like it seemed from his story that the Chinese police, they didn't threaten the reporters. They basically threatened dissidents to not introduce reporters to other dissidents
during the Olympics.
Well, that was his personal thing. But in other cases, they took dissidents away to, go on vacation.
Oh, that's nice.
So it's like they tell reporters, well, we're not going to stop you from interviewing dissidents, which is technically true, because what they really did is they just stopped the dissidents from being available for interviews.
In Fong Jiang's case, they said, just be quiet and we'll give you your visa to get out of China.
Or your passport, which he should have been able to get anyway.
But they had just denied it because...
Yeah, we don't want you going outside the country and saying stuff about us, right?
Yeah.
But it reminds me actually of those protest zones that they had set
Welcome
up in Beijing.
Welcome to the protest zone.
Do you remember this?
The protest zones, yeah.
I was just a wee lad back then.
Uh-huh, yes. You were hardly...
I must have been...
You were still getting your master's at NYU.
No, that was before. I was nary a day over 25.
Anyway, you had a point about the protest zones?
Yeah, I was the protest zones. Do you remember where they were like, yes, we will allow protests, and then they had these protest zones that were, like, I don't know, as far away as you could possibly get from anything that was actually happening, and then basically warn people off against actually showing up there.
Right. Good enough, right? I mean, did you see the opening ceremony? It was amazing.
Yeah, it really was, Shelley. I mean, didn't you watch it on TV?
I probably did, because I probably had both a TV and, cable back then.
I remember watching it on TV.
10 years ago feels like a long time ago.
Yeah.
Like, there was barely YouTube 10 years ago.
In 2 years, 1990 will be 30 years ago.
Hmm.
Do you realize, we are closer to the year 2030 than we are to 2003?
And our own mortality overshadows the discussion of China. Dun, dun, dun. So what kills me about the Olympics is just how well it worked. Like, so many people around the world bought it. That, this is what is happening in China. It's great. And you see the Communist Party being very successful at manipulating its image to get people on... Well, essentially get people to promote a more China-friendly agenda. And Shelley, you mentioned the Politico article. I think the other big...
Bombshell?
Yeah. The other bombshell in the Politico article was that a staffer for Senator Dianne Feinstein may have been spying for China at some point in his or her 20-year career working with her.
Yeah, I mean, that was a pretty big revelation. And then it just said that when the FBI informed Feinstein that they thought that one of her staffers had been spying, that she fired the person. But then nothing else ever happened with him.
Yeah, it was surprising that what should be a pretty big story was just kind of kept hush-hush, especially since she was on the Senate Intelligence Committee, which is a pretty sensitive intelligence committee.
The Senate Intelligence Committee, which is a pretty sensitive intelligence committee.
I see. It's a pretty, what do you say? It's a pretty sensitive intelligence.
They talk about high-level stuff.
Okay.
Right. Stuff.
Yeah.
Stuff is a good general word that describes all things.
Yeah, I was just wondering when we were going to cut that in. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, no, not this whole thing.
We're going to have this whole thing in there?
No, we're not.
But at any rate, I mean, Feinstein said, this guy didn't have security clearance. No one in my San Francisco office had security clearance. But that doesn't...
actually a spokesperson.
Who said that? Yeah, that's right. But of course, that doesn't mean that you can't provide valuable intelligence, even if you don't have high level security clearance, because the security issues that are talked about in the Senate Intelligence Committee then make their way into the actions and policy of that senator and what their office starts to work on.
Yeah, I mean, although it doesn't even need to be necessarily high-level security information. Like, it could be political information regarding, like, U.S. politics, like, different things. It would all be valuable to the Chinese Communist Party.
Especially since what came out is that Feinstein had... Well, the Chinese Communist Party had been cultivating a relationship with Feinstein for a very long time.
Yeah, which is why I don't even think the spy thing is, like, the big deal in this story. Like, it's a big deal, but, you know, I think, you know, because when you were researching the story, you kind of dug up how much there, how big of a relationship there was and already had been between Feinstein and the Chinese leadership.
If anything, it shows that even with a U.S. politician that they have such a close relationship with, they will still try and get somebody to spy.
I mean, you got to cover your bases.
Ah, the good old baseball analogies that go so well in China.
Yeah, but I think, you know, so Feinstein had been cultivating a relationship with Jiang Zemin for decades, and when she
knows who was cultivating who, actually.
Yeah, well, so she was mayor of San Francisco for 10 years.
Your old stomping ground.
Yeah, and my dad actually knew her. Funny story, this one time, like, he was trying to work with her on some community project because she was mayor, and he brought her a milkshake.
Really?
Yeah.
Was your dad one of the boys brought to the yard by Feinstein's milkshake?
No. It's just like, I guess things were more casual in like the 70s where, like, you know, people would bring each other milkshake. I don't know, like, whatever it was. That's not the point. The point is that, you know, my dad actually knew her and they were on a first name basis.
Enough to buy her a milkshake.
Enough to I think he actually made the milkshake.
Really?
Wow.
Yeah, or maybe my mom had made the milkshake and then he had brought it to her. But at any rate.
Neither of you have ever made me a milkshake. Actually, Matthew brought me a milkshake one time, I seem to remember.
Yeah, I did, actually.
Shelley, not once have you given me a milkshake.
If I gave you a milkshake, would you drink it?
Oh, no.
Not currently, right?
Let's not talk about that.
Yeah.
But at any rate, so, I mean, she was the mayor, and, you know, in a lot of ways, she was a very capable mayor.
We're totally derailing Matt's Feinstein story here, talking about milkshakes.
No, but the point is that, like, she was clearly like an up and coming politician, right? Showed a lot of potential, and, you know, by and large, a lot of people in the San Francisco community liked her, and they, you know, they saw work she was doing for you know, end discrimination and that sort of thing. What happened though is that she ended up having this relationship with the mayor of Shanghai, which was at the time Jiang Zemin, who was the mayor and party secretary of Shanghai, who didn't become the leader of China until the 90s. But they ended up having this relationship. I imagine that influenced her. There's one article I read that said that she basically made a trip to China roughly every year since she started having that relationship.
And Jiang Zemin visited her in San Francisco too. There was a Thanksgiving dinner
at her house with her husband. Yeah,
stories of them like singing together.
There's that photo we showed on China Uncensored.
Yeah,
of her and Jiang Zemin singing karaoke with Willie Brown in the background. Willie Brown became mayor later, or maybe was mayor in that photo. But yeah, kind of a weird. You know, Willie Brown also had a pretty tight relationship with Chinese leadership, but that's a whole other story. But I mean, kind of what it shows you is that the Chinese Communist Party did actually a very good job of cultivating relationships with influential people in San Francisco.
Before they even reached their highest levels. They start early.
Right. And San Francisco has always been an important place. It had an important Chinese-American community in the United States in the mid-19th century. And there's always been the Chinatown there is very old. There's been people living there for a long time. And I remember when I was a kid, I would go to Chinatown in San Francisco and I'd see the Chinese flags. But the Chinese flags were actually the Taiwan flag.
The Republic of China flag.
And, you know, gradually it started to change. But I didn't really notice it until, I remember in the early 2000s, I was working for Pacific Gas and Electric Company in San Francisco. And I went to Chinatown and I was like, wait a second, all the flags are now the People's Republic of China and not the ones I remember from my childhood when they were the Republic of China flag, which is Taiwan. So what's interesting is like gradually Chinatown in San Francisco had gone from largely being pro-Republic of China or pro-Taiwan to being pro-People's Republic of China. And it's interesting to see that in the Chinese community because you don't see it happening in other overseas ethnic communities. I'll give an example. In the Philippines, when Marcos was the dictator, the vast majority of overseas Filipinos were anti-Marcos dictatorship. And the newspapers, the Filipino newspapers in the U.S. Were all anti-Marcos. And I knew one of the leaders of the Filipino community through my father. And like, you know, it was all like, we've got to get rid of this dictatorship. If you look at the Vietnam protests in the U.S., it's like, why, you know, what is that flag that they have with the stripes? That's actually the South Vietnam flag that overseas Vietnamese use as a sort of protest against the communist regime in Vietnam. And so, like, what's different about the Chinese overseas community is that they've gone to, instead of being pro, you know, the free part of China, Taiwan, they've gradually over the last 20 years become pro People's Republic of China.
Well, there are multiple reasons for this.
Oh, yeah, lots of reasons.
Yeah.
But I wanted to highlight that because I think that that ties into this elite capture that you were talking about, which is that the Communist Party has done an excellent job of getting the elites in the United States, and whether it's mainstream American politicians or people in the Chinese community who are business people or other influential people, to become more and more pro-China in the sense of being pro-Chinese Communist Party.
Because when Feinstein became Senator Feinstein in the 90s, she was one of the loudest voices promoting normalized trade relations with China.
Yeah. Right. And even in 96 or 93, 94, she was arguing for it on the floor of the Senate. And then she wrote that op-ed in 1996. Mm-hmm. That was about
how favored status is not a perk.
Right. And about how we should obviously have like most favored nation trading status with China, where like keep in mind in context, this is only 7 years after the Tianmen Square Massacre.
Well, I mean, she was good friends with Jiang Zemin, who became the leader of China because he supported the Tianmen Square Massacre.
I'm sure she actually didn't know that.
Yeah. But I mean, like, so the strategy is of elite capture is actually, it's a very, like, long-term patient strategy. And again, just because I'm originally from San Francisco, like, I know how the Communist Party has been able to influence and build relationships with people in San Francisco. So as I mentioned, Willie Brown, the mayor, Willie Brown, was very pro-Communist Party. Gavin Newsom, who was a mayor in the mid-2000s, who's quite possibly going to be the next California governor, also had a tight relationship with certain Chinese officials. And Mayor Ed Lee, who's like a third, he passed away recently, but he was like a third-generation Chinese-American. And nobody assumed that he would have any, you know, ties to the Communist Party. And I don't think he ever did until he became mayor. And then he ended up having a very tight relationship with the Chinese consulate on Chinese New Year. 1 year, he actually raised the PRC flag above San Francisco City Hall. And so you've got this string of San Francisco mayors who've all had this relationship with Chinese officials. And this is elite capture. When you get American politicians and influential people to just, you know, become pro-Chinese Communist Party.
Yeah, and I think one of the interesting things about the way that the Communist Party approaches this when it comes to officials is they're very, I'd say, party agnostic. Like, they don't really care if you're Republican or if you're Democrats, or when we're in Australia, like, they donated to all the different political parties. They're looking for individual people that they can influence, and they'll take them wherever they can get them.
Yeah, they're even less partisan than a lot of Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever have any experience or any encounters with Feinstein?
So actually, I met Feinstein once, and I think it was 2003 or 2004. I was living in California at the time, and I was in D.C. meeting with different congresspeople about human rights in China. And we went to Dianne Feinstein's office at the Senate office building to raise the issue of how the Chinese Communist Party is persecuting Falun Gong, which the Communist Party was describing as a cult. And we were trying to say, like, look, this is a real human rights issue. All that stuff is propaganda. You know, we should, you know, I want you to sign a bill that stands up for this, right? We're meeting with all sorts of congresspeople. We get to her office, and we've been trying to arrange a meeting with Feinstein herself, but her office was like, oh, she's not going to be available that day. You know, we'll have you meet with one of her staff. So we get there, but instead of letting us come into the office, they actually say, wait in the hallway, like the hallway of the Senate office building, and we'll send someone out to meet you. So they send some guy out. We express our concerns, and he's, you know, not rude to us, except for making a stand in the hallway, but he was, you know, a little bit dismissive. Just didn't go well. So anyway, you know, of course, we realized that by not having us come into the office, we didn't sign in, so there's no official record of this meeting. We also learned that after this meeting, the guy we'd met with in the hallway was not even one of her, like, main staffers. The guy was her driver. I know, right? So anyway, we wrapped up this not very good meeting, and then I see Senator Feinstein walking down the hallway, and I'm like, this is my opportunity. So I go up to her and I say, Senator Feinstein, you know, it's nice to meet you. My name's Matt Ganeshda. She just doesn't care. I was like, oh, you know my father.
He made you a milkshake.
Yeah, I didn't say that part, but, you know, I said, you know my father, Bob Ganeshda. I want to talk to you about an important human rights issue that's happening in China right now. I want to talk to you about Falun Gong. And she looks at me and says, I don't support cults. And then walks off.
Whoa.
Yeah, and I'm like kind of dumbstruck. And then a moment later, I see half a dozen Chinese men in black suits and black ties walking down the hall and then walking into her office to meet with her. So she was willing to meet with Chinese officials, and I'm almost certain they were officials because of the way they dressed and acted. She was willing to meet with Chinese officials but refused to meet with her own constituents who had a legitimate concern and a specific policy thing they wanted her to talk with her about.
Did you know at the time she had been having Thanksgiving dinner with Jiang Zemin, the guy who started the persecution?
No, I had no idea. She was my senator. You know, I just figured, like, I was agnostic about this. I was just talking with all sorts of congresspeople, but like I was actually her constituent. So I just figured, like, this is another person that, you know, I really ought to talk to because I think she'll have a huge impact on foreign policy. Well, I was right about that part, but I don't think I was right that she'd be very interested in what we had to say.
Yeah, it is amazing the impact she did have on U.S. foreign policy because when in 1999, when Bill Clinton was trying to get China into the WTO, the World Trade Organization, at one point, negotiations kind of soured because the U.S. may have accidentally bombed a Chinese consulate somewhere and killed some people. That's kind of a whoopsie-daisy in high-level diplomatic dealings, so I've heard.
Was that the same year of the spy plane incident, too?
I think it was. Wasn't that related somehow?
Well, the spy plane was later, but anyway. Yeah.
Well, so anyways, like, it was going bad, and the White House basically sent Feinstein to China to talk to Jiang Zemin and kind of smooth things out.
You got to use that guanxi, that relationship stuff, yeah.
I wonder if she brought him a milkshake. Your dad might be the reason China's in the WTO.
No, I really would not like to take credit for that.
I think the interesting thing about this whole Feinstein thing, too, is if you look at the public record, like if you go back and dig into her past, it's all there. Mm-hmm. It's just, we're just like, but a lot of it actually was a pretty big scandal for her in the mid 90s. Like, a lot of these articles that we found were from, like, 94.
Before China had put out the Olympics and made it a nice image.
Yeah.
It was fresh off Tiananmen Square
Massacre. That was a big deal, but also...
the Tiananmen Square Massacre was a big deal.
Yeah, I know. But I was thinking of the whole Bill Clinton China Gate thing.
Oh, yeah.
That was, like, around that time, too. So,
you know, there was even Feinstein played into that somehow. I didn't include it in the episode because it was kind of a little tangential.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, there was some event she hosted where Clinton and the guy involved in the China Gate thing was there as well.
Mm-hmm. And then just a couple years later, the FBI warned Feinstein, among other people, that, like, the Chinese government was looking to, like, donate to her campaign or whatever, mm-hmm. to influence her. So,
yeah,
like...
I believe she returned that money or turned it down.
Mm-hmm.
There was some money that, I guess, was questionable, and so she did return it. And as a senator, she does have to disclose her assets.
Yeah, I mean...
You don't think she returned it out of the goodness of her heart? Out of doing the right thing for the American people?
Yeah, that probably was it. Yeah. Oh, but this is the other side of the story. While she was arguing to normalize trade relations with China, just for context, after the Tiananmen Square Massacre, Congress had to approve trade with China every year because people were a little upset by that whole, you know, massacring student things.
Yeah, and they're kind of using that as leverage to try to force China to make some reforms because they didn't meet certain metrics or whatever, then the threat is Congress is not going to approve trade next year.
And didn't Feinstein say that, like, Tiananmen Square thing, that was in the past. China's learned its lesson. It's moved on.
Yeah.
This, again, was, like, less than 10 years after the Tiananmen Square massacre.
Would you say 25 years after it's learned its lesson?
Well, I was going to say, actually, almost exactly 10 years later, like 10 years and a month later, they started the crackdown on Falun Gong.
And so, in a way, they did kind of learn their lesson because the way that they went after Falun Gong was fundamentally different. It was done out of the public eye. They used a massive propaganda campaign to make Falun Gong practitioners look as bad as possible.
Even internationally.
And so the Communist Party did learn an important lesson, which is if you're going to kill your own citizens, do it on the DL.
Well, they tried it with the Tiananmen Square students, saying that, like, they were violent and armed, and the military, you know, they were unarmed, and they were getting attacked by these students. People didn't really buy that, especially when there's videotape of the tanks crushing students. It's a little hard.
In China, people eventually bought that. But I think the difference, though, in terms of the public thing related to the Falun Gong persecution is that there was no way to, like, make the Tiananmen Square protests go away in a quiet way. They were already publicly there. There was already massive, you know, amounts of foreign media who just happened to be in Beijing to cover Mikhail Gorbachev going to Beijing. So, like, there was, like, this kind of confluence of events that made it pretty much impossible to hide the fact that they were gunning down people on Chang'an Avenue. But with the Falun Gong thing, it's like they were in charge of when that started.
They had total control.
And it's interesting because I think the Falun Gong, like, the way that they did that particular crackdown, you see it now again in the way that they did crackdown in Tibet after 2008. And now with the Uyghurs in Xinjiang, like, a lot of it is pretty reminiscent.
See, Feinstein's right. She learned their lesson.
You know what's interesting? It's like every 10 years, there's, like, another persecution thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So 89 Tiananmen Massacre, 99 persecution of Falun Gong, 2008, close enough, they go after Tibetans and essentially lock down Tibet. And roughly 2018 is when they start sending hundreds of thousands of Uyghurs to re-education camps. So, like, they've got this kind of system.
What will it be in 2028?
Ooh, who's next?
What do you think? Leave your comments below.
Oh, this is dark. So anyways, back to Feinstein. So while she's arguing for normalize trade relations and getting China to the WTO, her husband also happens to be doing a lot of business in China.
Feinstein's actually the third richest senator, I think, in terms of her net worth.
She's worth like, what, $50 million or something?
More. I mean, there's a weird range where it's like, the last numbers I saw were 47 to 110 million, which seems like maybe too large of a range, but
yeah, yeah. But people who are very wealthy, like sometimes it's very difficult to assess the net worth because you've got dozens and dozens of different investments and some of them are part ownership. So it's understandable. But
so you're saying even though I may seem very poor, I might actually be very rich?
Oh, no, you're actually like deeply in debt because of your student loans. You have no way out, essentially.
The value of an education.
That's what you get for trying to get a master's degree.
The value of an education is measured in negatives.
So Feinstein, who could has enough money to pay off your student loan debts with only a tiny, tiny fraction of her net worth.
Oh, my gosh.
But won't after this.
No.
So
wait, was it an option if I hadn't said these things about her? Feinstein is great. She's leading the way. China relations for the win.
That was very convincing. I'm sure.
Did I sound sarcastic?
I'm sure she's convinced now.
Dang.
Yeah, her husband, Richard Blum, like he is an investment banker, and he had made lots of lucrative investments in China starting in the mid-90s. I mean, he basically got in before a lot of people did.
Actually, in particular because of Feinstein and Jiang Zemin's relationship.
But they both denied.
They both say they have their own independent relationships.
Yes,
in
Feinstein
China.
And her husband denied that her relationships helped his businesses in China. Mm-hmm.
But wasn't there that organization that they set up that he became the director of?
Yeah. Well, also, this is notwithstanding that when Feinstein met with Jiang Zemin, her husband, Richard Blum, was also at a lot of those meetings, which is kind of unusual.
That's what the Times said.
Right. So, like, yes, they have independent relationships, but when she brings her husband to a meeting with Jiang in Beijing, or when she invites Jiang over to their house for Thanksgiving in San Francisco, like, the lines are very blurred here.
And what a lot of experts on doing business in China have said is that, you know, being seen with Jiang Zemin would have really helped Blum in his business in China.
Sure. I mean, Jiang's own children were put in charge of many, like, state-involved businesses, right?
Right, irrespective of their qualifications.
Yeah.
But at any rate, like, that's not to say that Feinstein did anything that's illegal. I mean, there are lots of laws that try to prevent conflicts of interest, and I think Feinstein was pretty careful to not violate those laws as far as what I've been able to find from research. But that doesn't mean that there weren't some things that were a bit that the public might disapprove of, let's say.
Well, I mean, I think it definitely shows from even your interaction with her, Matt, that her, you know, opinions or views on certain issues related to human rights in China were very colored by her relationship with Chinese officials.
Yeah. And so when you have not just a senator, but like a very influential senator whose views are on certain issues are heavily influenced by the Chinese Communist Party, like that's not a great thing to have in this country.
Well, I mean, especially I think now as the U.S. government is moving into possibly a more confrontational like stance with China.
Right.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what Feinstein says about, you know, Chinese spying in the U.S.
Or, because she's running for a fifth term as senator, yeah. So she should be around.
Yeah, she may not win. I mean, A, she's 85, mm-hmm. and B, because of the way the California elections are, she may have another Democrat running against her.
She will be running against a Democrat, but it's the same Democrat she ran against in the primaries, and in the primaries she carried 44%. And he got like 19 or something. Mm.
So we don't know. But at any rate, yeah, I think that if I were Feinstein, if the issue of Chinese spies comes up, I would just keep my full mouth shut.
I think she is doing that, especially about the spy in her own office.
She has kept her mouth pretty shut on this issue.
But like what I think is interesting too is that we kind of like what I brought up earlier about the fact that like all this stuff is visible if from the 90s, is that like it seems so long ago to people. Like the Beijing Olympics was 10 years ago, but that feels forever ago, like politically and geopolitically and where the world is now. And 20 years ago, there were, like, Feinstein was already elite captured, if you want to put it like that. But, you know, everybody forgets.
Yeah. And you see that with businesses, too. The big story that broke is that Google had a secret plan that was really only known to top-level executives and some managers.
And some the people who were working on the secret plan.
And the people working on the secret plan of starting a new censored Chinese search engine.
Yes, like an app for Android that would go in China and be a censored version of Google.
Yeah, well, Google has also kind of been pretty tight-lipped about this, even when the media... I mean, you, Shelley, contacted their spokesperson.
Well, I mean, they have, like, their press inquiries line, and when you ask about it, they send you their boilerplate, "We don't comment about future plans."
Yeah. And it's funny, because this follows in at the end of 2017, the current CEO made a trip to China, and since then, there has been a renewal of relations with Google and China. Google has set up a new AI research center in China.
They've bought different interests in different Chinese companies.
Mm-hmm.
They like launched a game on WeChat. Like they're definitely taking, even before this Intercept broke the story about this secret censored search engine in development, like you could see that they were like taking, like making moves to get back into the China market in some way or another.
And the funny thing is, earlier this year, Google had been working with the Pentagon on AI technology. And when word of that came out, a bunch of Google employees were very, very upset. Some even quit. And it kind of became this little scandal. And so Google said, "All right, no more. We won't do any AI research that could lead to weapons."
Mm-hmm.
And yet, with an AI research center in China,
I mean, technically, there's no evidence that the Google AI research in China is leading to weapons development.
I actually would extremely doubt that. But
right. Yeah, but I mean, like, when you do business in China, you have to work with Chinese officials. You almost always have to do it as part of a joint venture partnership with another.
Yes.
With a Chinese company.
The search engine will have a joint venture partner, too.
Right.
And what the AI is being used for in China is for censorship and monitoring people.
Well, but that's not weapons.
That's true. It could lead people to be killed, but...
Well, I think...
But don't worry. It's the human police that would do the killing.
Well,
the AI.
Really, we need to engage with China. Like, we can't just ignore it and its vast, vast profits.
I think it's interesting to see the difference in how Google has treated this scandal involving this search engine, because there was also a massive outcry inside Google after this news broke that they were doing a censored search engine.
Mm-hmm.
And people were upset. And then, like, apparently what Google did was just lock it down, like, denied people access to documents until they could like lock down specific documents related to the search engine. Like it was just like, and then just not saying anything publicly. They still haven't made any kind of statement.
Like not to their employees. Like it's just been.
Yeah. Not internally, not externally. They're just like, I don't know. Do they think it's going to go away if they just don't say anything about it?
I think they must, because like they kind of have, I think, two options at this point. One of them is to make a decision that, you know what, we've made a mistake. This is a bad idea. We're not going to work with them. Our employees feel strongly about this, and we're going to do that, right? They could come up with a reason. The other option is to go ahead with the China search engine. And the way to do that is to try to make the controversy go away. And it seems like that's what they're doing. Although,
just wait it out.
Yeah, wait it out.
But I don't know if this is going to work in the current environment, because as you said, Shelley, the U.S. government is taking a much more confrontational stance towards China. So I don't think this is how it would have been even 5 years ago.
Yeah, and it's not going to go away, especially as long as, you know, satirical news shows about China keep talking about it.
Unless they keep making it impossible to find the show on YouTube.
Oh, right, because we're on Google's YouTube platform. Yeah, oh, that's, yeah. I don't want to get Alex Jones'd.
I think if you are a Google engineer who is working on the secret Dragonfly search engine project and you would like to contact us,
please email chinaunscripted@gmail.com.
Yeah, this week has been kind of depressing for me, finding out like a high-ranking U.S. official has been leaked, captured by China, that Google, the world's largest search engine, is also now being kind of subverted by China. It's like, it's an uphill battle we're fighting. Melancholy.
But on the plus side... I was trying to think of something, but I couldn't actually think of anything.
Yeah. If you think of something on the plus side, please tell us. We're very sad. The laughing doesn't help with that. Thanks for listening to this episode of China Unscripted. I'm your sad, sad speaker, Chris Chappell.
I'm Shelley Zhang.
And I'm the producer, Matt Gnezda.
Wait, what am I? You both have a title.
I am a speaker. You can be a speaker, too.
You can be humor ninja.
Make us laugh, Shelley.
I'm not humor ninja-ing anything here.
You're accuracy ninja.
Nobody likes accuracy ninja.
No. No.
Accuracy Ninja never gets invited to the fun parties.
The costume parties.
The karaoke with Jiang Zemin.
Oh, yeah. When I actually was able to find out what song that they were singing, which was funny to me that, like, I was like, I wonder if I could actually figure out, because you found the photo first, mm-hmm. and I was like, I wonder if I could figure out what they're singing. And I could.
You're an expert in lip reading, correct? Shelley?
Yes, from a still photo. Yes. That's why.
Uh-huh. The actual song was...
One Day When We Were Young, which I had never heard of before. It's apparently from an old movie called The Great Waltz, like a movie musical from the 30s.
Yeah, Jiang Zemin liked to sing like a bunch of like old, like weird songs and like American songs.
He sang O Sole Mio, like in front of Pavarotti, right? Something like that.
Oh, yeah, which is weird. He also one time like played... Was it like Mozart's piano or something?
Yeah, I heard the caretaker was not very happy about that.
Well, because he wasn't playing Mozart. He was playing like some honky-tonk song. Like it was like super disrespectful.
Honky-tonk?
Hey, if Mozart were alive today, he'd be honky-tonk.
So what does this have to do with China again?